Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Rick Gray. Today I'll be reading from Good Old Days Magazine, the May-June edition. If you followed the last program from this magazine, you may recall that the theme of this month's issue is community neighborhoods. The first story was sent in by Pamela Tabone, as told to Vincenza Nancioni. The title is Nothing Like Riding Together. Seeing him on his motorcycle brought back memories of the love and fun they shared. 4 years ago, while visiting my husband's Aunt Vincenza Nancioni, Auntie Vinci, who was turning 97, I noticed a vintage picture close to her rocking chair. It was a black and white photo of a handsome fellow who I recognized as her husband, Elio, sitting on a motorcycle. Intrigued by the design of the bike, I asked, "Do you know the year of the motorcycle and make?" She pondered for a few moments and said, "I think it is a 1937 Indian Chief. It was built by the Hendy Manufacturing Company in Springfield, Massachusetts, from 1922 until the end of the company's existence in 1953. I chuckled to myself and thought that even at her age, the memories were still alive and she could recall even the smallest details. She went on to tell me that even as a teenager, Uncle Elio always had a passion for motorcycles and loved the freedom of the open road. So before they married in 1941, he purchased the 1937 Indian Chief. He would spend countless hours washing, tuning, and shining up the exhaust pipes and mufflers in anticipation of their special outings and dates. She said he wasn't happy until he saw his reflection. When we were courting in our small town of Bulger, Pennsylvania, he would pick me up on his bike, give me a helmet, and off we went. Our favorite place to go was Rock Springs Park in Chester, West Virginia. Her face was radiant as she relived the past, reminiscing about how they both loved riding the high-speed roller coasters, swimming in the outdoor pool, and strolling through the gardens filled with colorful flowers. Buying food at the park was out of the question, so she would pack a wicker picnic basket with fried chicken and homemade bread, which they enjoyed in the pavilion. When their date ended, Uncle Elio had her home before curfew. She chuckled and said, "The reason for making sure I was home before curfew was because everyone heard when we pulled up to my parents' house. The chief had a loud roar." A year after they exchanged their wedding vows, Aunt Vinci became pregnant. Although the Indian chief provided them with many wonderful memories, they both decided it was time to say goodbye to their past and sell the chief. At the end of our visit with Auntie Vinci, she looked over to the picture of Uncle Elio and his motorcycle. Smiling with affectionate eyes, she said, "Those were the good old days." The next story was submitted by Lynn Cassidy. It's entitled Decoration Day of My Childhood. This family came together to remember those before them by cleaning their resting places. Decoration Day was what we called Memorial Day in 1960 when I was a child in Dearborn, Missouri. It was a day in May when families went to cemeteries to decorate the graves of loved ones. The flowers were usually peonies or homegrown roses in tin cans wrapped in aluminum foil, perhaps with a ribbon tied around the can. Although I later found out that the day of decorating was founded to remember deceased soldiers of the Civil War, I only knew it as the day we remembered deceased members of our family. It wasn't until 20 years later that I discovered I had a great-grandfather who was a Civil War veteran. The tradition of putting flowers on graves began around 1866, with both Union and Confederate sides claiming to have been the first to honor their war dead with spring flowers. It was the Uniform Monday Holiday Act, passed by Congress in 1968, that officially changed Decoration Day to Memorial Day. It went into effect in 1971. In rural areas, the entire cemetery, not just the markers themselves, sometimes had to be cleared days before the holiday. These final resting places were on private property and weren't always kept up. Then families with members buried there would take a day to clear the overgrown vegetation so the decorating could be done without brambles or, hopefully, snakes. My family did this. I remember the day in 1960 when the men on my mom's side of the family spent a day cleaning the cemetery. I was about 8 years old then. Grandpa, Dad, my uncle, and great-uncle cleared weeds in the morning, while my grandmother, mom, and great-aunt made a picnic lunch for the workers. Gathering to clean and decorate graves resulted in many family reunions and picnics afterwards. My dad would drive to the neighboring town with a meat market and buy steaks to grill. Usually our family of seven couldn't afford steak, so instead hot dogs were roasted and potato chips and sweet tea were served. Baseball, tag, Red Rover, and more games were played with cousins who gathered from other states to honor our ancestors. Sometimes a horse or two would be rounded up, and we would take turns riding them around the yard. After a solemn morning, it just seemed a return to rambunctious life was necessary. Vacations were a part of that time of year, too. Dad earned 2 weeks' vacation from his job at TWA, but due to his seniority, he had to take them late in the spring or early in the summer. In 1965, we headed west to visit Dad's brother and family in Denver. Mom and Dad planned a detour that year. Instead of cutting through Kansas at night, as we usually did, they preferred we slept instead of asking, "Are we there yet?" We went way up north to see Mount Rushmore first and then Old Faithful at Yellowstone Park before driving south to Denver. The springtime weather in northwest Missouri was usually pretty warm. Not so as we traveled through South Dakota and Wyoming in May. We thought we were going to freeze as we camped in areas with snow on the ground. Our mode of transportation was Dad's pickup truck with a camper on the bed. With blow-up mattresses on the floor and a second layer of plywood for the rest of us, body heat kept us somewhat warm. Yet we were glad to gather around the Coleman gas stove while Mom cooked a breakfast of bacon and eggs or biscuits and gravy. Once, when we were stopped for supper to get broasted chicken, the owner of the cafe had to come see for himself why Dad ordered so much food. His eyes grew round when he saw the five of us kids in that small camper after Dad opened the door. Mom and Dad had managed to rig up an intercom between the front seats and the camper where we kids were riding. At 5 years old, my younger sister Kathy couldn't make up her mind if she wanted to be in front with them or ride in the back with us older kids. When she got in the back, she would inevitably get tired of riding all day and would start fussing. She'd hit the intercom button to say she wanted back up front. Either that, or one of us would push that rectangular white button and yell, "Make Kathy ride up there with you." It took some time, but eventually we did see Mount Rushmore and Old Faithful, and we arrived in Denver to stay with our cousins. Our arrival usually took place in the middle of the night, and our dad's sense of direction was terrible. Consequently, we would drive around Denver looking for a phone booth so Dad could call his brother, Chilt, for directions. Chilt knew about Dad's poor sense of direction because when Dad hung up, he would tell us, "Chilt's on his way. We'll follow him to their house." Chilt got out of bed many nights to rescue us over the years. When we arrived at their house, our cousins would scoot over in bed to make room for us and fall back asleep until morning when the games began. Decoration Day, or Memorial Day as it's known now, has changed in the intervening 60 years. But when I see peonies blooming in lilacs on the bushes, I know it's time to decorate my family's graves. I also recall the widows and mothers who grieved and decorated their husbands' and sons' graves in the aftermath of the Civil War and later wars. We remember them all during that weekend in May. The next story was sent in by Michael Calillo, entitled The Social Club of Forest Avenue. The growth of the country after the war brought young families together in their new neighborhoods. World War II had been over for a few years, and the soldiers and sailors had returned home. They wished to get on with the next phase of their lives, getting married and raising a family. Servicemen married their sweethearts in droves, often after short periods of romancing. And with marriages, of course, came baby carriages. The economy was surging. Men found jobs in the steel mills, rubber plants, aluminum foundries, and so forth. There was land out there beyond the borders of the urban grind. The newly built suburbs blossomed. Many took off to the greater Cleveland area, to smaller cities like Euclid, Westlake, Bedford, and Parma. In 1948, my parents' fledgling family of four moved from West 25th Street, Pearl Road, to Forest Avenue in Parma, Ohio. Our neighborhood was truly a melting pot. There were people of English, Italian, Hungarian, German, and Russian extraction among them. Pretty much all of us were in the same economic condition of the growing middle class. The houses were built quite close together, so neighbors got to know each other in their backyards while hanging out wash on the clothesline or doing yard work. My mother, perhaps reminiscing back to her growing up days in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Cleveland, knew that she could put her organizational skills to task by melding these disparate families into a social network. She proceeded to start a network social club on Forest Avenue. She went right to work, contacting the people and offering invitations to them. And who had to host the first event? We did, of course. By this time, around 1959, I had come along to join my siblings, so I witnessed firsthand all of this unfolding. As I recall, there were about 9 couples at first. The get-together was held in our unfinished basement, complete with my father's handmade shelves and storage on the east wall. The women dressed up and a few of the guys wore sports jackets and maybe ties. The event included a meal and, of course, conversation during and after. Usually my mother would try to include some type of game at the event. The neighborhood went on to hold more of these get-togethers, and a few of them were held at our house again. Chex Party Mix was a popular snack served back then, along with many Vienna sausages. Eventually, all the houses in that subdivision had been built and were occupied by young families. The families started maturing, adding more children, moving up economically. A few families moved on out to newer and bigger houses in the new burbs like Independence and Strongsville. Around about 1968, our neighborhood gathering stopped. Soon, these get-togethers were reduced to just 4 of the women meeting often to go see a drama production in downtown Cleveland or just go out to a restaurant for lunch. But back in the booming 1950s, it seemed that everything was on a meteoric rise to the future, with the swinging 60s coming right behind it. The next story by Michael O'Donnell falls under Looking Hollywood Way. The title is A Story of Community. Did the town take to him or him to the town? Based on John Burris's book of the same name, The Missouri Traveler, 1958, is a movie about a runaway teenage orphan boy named Bjarne, who finds himself attached to the small town of Delphi, Missouri, after some of its residents take an interest in him. The story takes place early in the 20th century, and the town is described as having been passed by with no railroad. On the other hand, there's no crime, and since the local temperance league succeeded in banning liquor from the town, though the former saloon owner serves a coffee at his restaurant that is unaccountably popular among the men there, there is little excitement, except perhaps when a certain man ties his horse to the statue of the town's founder. The orphan, Bjorn, was played by Brandon DeWilde. Born in 1942, DeWilde already had an impressive acting resume by 1958. At age 7, he appeared on Broadway in The Member of the Wedding with Ethel Waters and Julie Harris. He completed 492 performances and joined Waters and Harris in the 1952 film version of the play. The next year, he appeared in the movie for which he is best known, Shane, in 1953, with Alan Ladd, Gene Autry, and Van Heflin, and for which he was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. He continued to make movies and many television appearances as he grew into adulthood. Unfortunately, DeWilde was killed in a car accident in 1972. The man who first encounters Bjorn is Tobias Brown, played by Lee Marvin. Tobias is a hard-shelled, self-made man who likes to annoy the town's leading citizen, played by Mary Hosford. Traveler is her only film credit. Lee Marvin was born in 1924 and enlisted in the Marines at age 18. He served in the Pacific and was wounded in June 1944, being one of the few in his company to survive the Battle of Saipan. After the war, he attended the American Theater Wing in New York on the GI Bill. He worked steadily in film throughout the 1950s and 60s, often as the heavy. Marvin won the Academy Award for Best Actor in his portrayal of Kid Shaleen, the drunkest gun in the West, in Cat Ballou in 1965. Marvin passed away from a heart attack in 1987. The man who treats Bjorn with compassion and provides real help is the town's newspaper editor, Doyle McGee, played by Gary Merrill. It is through Doyle that Bjorn finds a place to live, an abandoned farm, and a purpose to take care of and train Doyle's horse, Twister, and to learn to be a farmer. Gary Merrill, born in 1915, had acting experience in theater and on radio before World War II. And while serving in the Army Air Forces, he appeared in both the play and movie versions of Winged Victory in 1944. These productions were used to raise money for the Army Emergency Relief Fund. In 1950, he played opposite Betty Davis in All About Eve. Merrill and Davis hit it off right away. The two were married in July 1950, but divorced in 1960. Merrill acted in television and movies and also did voice work until 1980. He passed away in 1990 from lung cancer. The townspeople in Traveler were portrayed by many character actors whose faces were and are familiar to audiences. Primary among them was Paul Ford, who played Finus Dougherty, former saloon owner and horse trainer. When a bet is made between Doyle and Tobias concerning a race between Twister and Tobias's best horse, it is Finus who steps up to help Bjorn train Twister while instructing the lad himself on how to handle the spirited horse and best win the race. Of the four principal actors in The Missouri Traveler, Paul Ford was the one with a gift for comedy. Born 1901, he didn't begin acting until he was in his 40s. He worked steadily in theater and on TV, and became a household name, or at least a household face, when he played Colonel Hall on The Phil Silvers Show from 1955 to 1959. You might also remember him as the mayor of River City, Iowa, in The Music Man, 1962. Ford retired from acting in 1972 and passed away from a heart attack in 1976. The Missouri Traveler has fine actors and a gentle demeanor that makes it a perfect family film. The story is about how the citizens of a town affect a young orphan boy. It's also about how the boy struggles to find his way to manhood, bring the people of the town together. The next article by Jennifer Broadstreet Hess falls under Good Old Days in the Kitchen. It's recollections of church picnics, That day each year was filled with fellowship, families, fun, and food. Now, I will read the story, but then I'll break off at the end because it goes into recipes, and we don't have the time to be doing recipes. Every June when I was a young girl, the First Baptist Church our family attended in Howard, Kansas, held their annual picnic at the city park. Many of our church friends were farm families, and gatherings where we were able to visit and sit a spell were rare. Right after the church service, friends started gathering at the park, close to the aged shelter house. The men would set up fold-down tables in the shade of some big walnut trees. The women covered the tables with brightly colored gingham tablecloths. It was the children's job to help carry our mothers' covered dishes, carefully wrapped in foil, to the buffet tables. I remember my mom instructing me as she placed the chilled bowls of seven-layer salad in my arms, "Walk slowly, don't run. You don't want to trip over the curb." Small in stature, my short arms could barely reach around that enormous Pyrex bowl. Then the families would enthusiastically line up single file by the food-laden tables, helping the younger children fill their plates. Everyone had worked up quite an appetite in the heat of the day. What a treat it was to eat some of the dishes the church ladies brought. Crispy fried chicken, meatloaf, bubbling macaroni and cheese, and my mother's refreshing seven-layer salad. Someone would usually bring an old-fashioned ice cream churn. Mrs. and Mr. Davis owned their own farm just outside town, and Mrs. Davis was usually the one to bring her homemade ice cream recipe. Mr. Davis would start the long, arduous job of churning the ice cream, carefully adding rock salt and ice from a cooler. Everyone enjoyed a relaxing day in the sunshine, catching up with one another's families. The men gathered in a circle, sitting on lawn chairs. The boys played a game of baseball. The girls looked after the younger children, pushing them on the swings or spinning them on the merry-go-round. We all enjoyed bowls of ice-cold homemade ice cream. Then, late in the afternoon, the gathering would draw to a close as families went their separate ways to head home. I hand-selected these recipes because they remind me of the fond memories my own family created while attending neighborhood get-togethers. My mom's seven-layer salad is still a fan favorite because it's both healthy and refreshing. I hope you would try one of my recipes and create your own cherished moments, gathering with neighbors and kin around the dining room table. And of course, being as mean-spirited as I am, I'm not going to read those recipes. The next story by Eileen Harnden comes under Good Old Days on Wheels. It's entitled, Our Old Friend the Goat. The family car took each member through the years. My good old days were the 1960s and early 70s. I grew up in Philita and Hazel Dell, rural communities near Vancouver, Washington. I got my first driver's license in 1970, and it opened my world to all sorts of adventures. That same year, my parents were late coming home for dinner one night, when, much to my surprise, they arrived in a brand new shiny 1970 Pontiac GTO. My brother and I hopped in for a spin. It didn't take us long to fall in love with this new purchase. And since that moment, I've had a love affair with white interiors and cars. My younger brother Sean and I loved the car, but it was for my mom, and she decided to be practical. So, much to our disappointment, she decided to exchange the 1970 GTO for a 1969 GTO. It was brand new, too, but it had air conditioning. Up in the Pacific Northwest, we'd only use air conditioning for maybe one day during the summer. I couldn't believe she settled on that car, which was dark green, so it wasn't as flashy as the previous one. However, it was an automatic with a 350-horsepower 400 engine. We had to resist the urge to put that pedal to the metal for sure, but that engine sure did sound nice. Mom actually allowed me to drive her car out one night with a friend to go visiting. I remember being nervous since I was such a new driver, and driving at night was not my favorite thing. Somehow I managed to scratch the passenger door. I ran out to investigate and saw a 2-inch scrape line on the door. Freaked out, I carefully came up with a plan. Don't tell her. Now, mind you, I was a good girl. I was responsible and I listened to my parents. Well, until my senior year. I even surprised myself sometimes then, but that's another story. A few days went by after I scraped the car with no word from Mom about it. I do recall thinking, maybe she'll think a person parked next to her did it. Either she thought that, or she never saw it, because she never said anything to me. She'll know now after I send her this manuscript, but I don't think I'll be in too much trouble. I wasn't really interested in pushing the car to its limits, but my brother, on the other hand, was all about speed. I remember him riding his 10-speed Schwinn bike, shifting gears like it was a race car. At the age of 14, he managed to slip out at night after my parents went to sleep and took the GTO to go joyriding. He made another mistake, telling me. Believe it or not, I kept it a secret at first, just to be a nice sister. But then, one evening as our family was going out somewhere, I was in the back seat with Sean and my parents started praising him about how well he'd done in school and what a wonderful son he was. Well, that was all I needed to hear. The next words that came out of my mouth spilled the beans on what their perfect son had done. I don't recall the punishment he got. It was probably restrictions, but they were big on that. Sean's nickname became the Brat. Time went on. I graduated and got married, and Sean ended up driving the GTO in high school. By that time, my dad had painted the car his business colors, white with black and red stripes. Once Sean acquired the car, off to the raceways he went, and he and his school chums drag raced. By that time, we had a nickname for the car, the Goat. Time continued to march on. Sean went off to college. I had children, and the Goat seemed to slip away into history. The car sat out all by itself next to the old barn at the farm where my parents lived for a while. When I drove by the car, I felt sad for it, as I revisited my memories of driving it in high school. Many years later, after many life changes, which included moving away from that area, I came back to Philita and Hazel Dell to drive to the places that held so many memories. My last stop was at my dad's old business office on the main highway. A lot of changes had been made, as in any growing city, and I realized they had put a car lot across the busy highway from the office. As I studied the cars from across the highway, one car jumped out at me. It was the Goat. I couldn't believe my eyes. I ran across the street with glee. Same car, same paint job. I hugged it like an old friend, tearing up as I am a hopeless sentimental. I keep my cars for years, and when I sell them, I give them a big hug of thanks. I wanted to buy the Goat at that moment, but I knew that wasn't going to happen. The car lot was closed, so I spent a few moments reminiscing in private, which helped me. Years later, as we were getting ready for my granddaughter's wedding day, I heard the sound of a familiar engine coming up the driveway. I ran out, and there in the driveway was a shiny red 1969 GTO. It had arrived from a relative who was loaning it to the bride and groom to drive off in after the wedding. So I wanted to believe it was the Goat. It affected my brother, my mother, and me. We melted in our hearts, and now we have my mom on video saying, "That's my GTO." That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the May-June edition of Good Old Days Magazine. I'm Rick Gray. So long until next time.